All right, so today we have Raji Ganesan. She is a distinguished technologist at Infosys. So Raji, welcome to the podcast.
Super happy to be here, Ben.
All right, so let's begin with interfaces, AI and interfaces. So I think you've discussed in the past, I've noticed that you've discussed in the past, and many people have made this observations, right? So that we're both builders and consumers of AI. So how does this dual relationship with this technology influence how we should design interfaces?
Yeah, that's a great way to start off, Ben. And today, if you look at the space of AI, a lot of advancements has happened on the large language model side, be it in terms of the knowledge or the reasoning, right? You see every day there's a new model being birthed, which is superb. But when we step back and look at it, are these models good? Are these consumable by users, right? That is where I think we lack the kind of user interface we need. If you look at the best possible example is ChatGPT, right? And ChatGPT like conversation, wherein you're typing a text, you're getting an answer, and you go round and round and turn by turn. It's never ending. And you have to give it so much of context. And if you don't give the context in the right format, you don't get the response. So these interfaces, while we think, are flexible, but in so-called the age of AI, which is AGI, which is coming up, this is not really good enough, I think, Ben. So we have a lot to do in this space.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is that while the models are evolving in kind of directionally this similar way, so in other words, right, so one provider adds reasoning, then the others provide reasoning. One provider lets you upload PDFs, the other lets you upload PDFs. But then one interesting observation on my part is I noticed that even the providers go out of their way to coach users, right? So, hey, we have a new model, version X, and this is how you should prompt version X, right? And this is true for all these providers. They have kind of coaching tips for how you prompt it. So one of the things you've talked about is kind of, as you have already alluded to, is this limitation of these chat interfaces, right? So to your mind, what alternatives should we be exploring?
That's a fantastic question, Ben. I really think so. If we really look at it, right, it's already there in some, we've made certain initial start. For example, if you look at GitHub Copilot, which developers use to write code, or any kind of mail application, there's a type ahead, right? These interfaces do not need you to give this heavy-duty prompting, right? The AI actually co-inhabits the same workspace as a user. So when you type a question, the context is derived from the environment or the IDE in this case of a developer. So you don't need prompting. So co-inhabited workspaces is a great example. And, you know, if you look at it, if you're sitting in a car and you're in a digital cockpit, you get so much of information in the live stream to you. You're not writing a prompt. The AI is not guiding you based on giving the context. So being able to take the context, the shared context between the user, so that's really the one part. The second part, more and more we are saying that generative interfaces are something which is emerging, right? And in case of generative interfaces, the beauty is that it's not the content which is generated, it's the experience which is generated by the machine. So I think we have a lot to do in that sense, Ben.
And so one of my pet peeves in this space, Raji, is the models are getting better, but investment in the interfaces is lagging, right? So, and I'm kind of torn about one aspect of it, which is basically, I do want an interface that unifies everything. In other words, right? So if I want to use audio or video or PDF, I should be able to do that. Now, some providers actually have different even URLs, right? So if you want to interact in this way, you go this to this one. And it's a bit of a difficult. And then the other thing is on the mobile side, on the phone, I don't consider myself as particularly having a thick accent, but it's still super annoying to interact with these applications on the phone. So as we enter the multimodal world, I mean, we're already lagging on the text interface, as you alluded to, right? So what would you like to see in terms of as we enter more and more into this multimodal world?
Yeah, that's... So when we look at it, I think we have to step back and ask, when we in this era of generative AI, right? We're generating content, which is text, which is audio, which is video, right? But what if we can generate interfaces, right? Which is experience, and get the user... give the user a more intuitive experience. It doesn't matter if it's voice or text. It has to be multimodal in nature. So today we are seeing the emergence as even in the enterprise side. So this is not really in the space of, let's say, gaming or metaverse, right? Wherein these interfaces are generated based on what you need. But even in, if you take in context of the enterprise where I work for, we are doing a lot of legacy modernization, and you would think that is one of the most boring areas. But that is the spot where you really need a good interfaces. It's not just in the fancy areas of gaming, the metaverse, but even in enterprise kind of situation where you're working with legacy and code understanding, we have been able to create these interfaces wherein the user who's looking at so much of legacy code and overwhelmed is able to walk into a latent space, which is an area which gives him an understanding of the areas he wants to explore, right? So a lot of advancements are coming from a generative AI itself, right? That's what I want to say, yeah.
Hey, so you just used the term there, latent space. So first of all, let's drill down on that and explain to our listeners what you mean by that.
Yeah. So I would see latent space is an area which for the user is meaningful in his interaction, in their interaction, right? So if you're using, let's say, a metaverse and you're wearing your XR glasses, you're pointing different things, right? I want to go here, I want to go there, right? It's a space which is relatable to the user, which is semantically understandable to the user and the user wants. So here with latent space, I want to go back to the legacy code modernization example, right? The user is saying, tell me all the modules which are, let's say, dealing with fraud detection, right? And to him, what he sees is a complete spaces of different fraud detection modules, maybe fraud detection based on countries, based on different geographic locations, and the user actually says, okay, I want to go into the fraud detection model related to Poland, and he clicks on it and goes into the space, right? So exploration of the space which a user wants is very much possible. Another way I've also seen this being implemented, Ben, is today we were building this brainstorming application, right? An application which helps you to brainstorm ideas. And let's say I'm launching a product and I go there saying, you know, I write the various aspects related to how this brainstorming has to happen. And the machine actually looks at my thought process. And when you're launching a product, you have 20, 30 things to do. In a ChatGPT kind of a conversation, it'll go ask one by one. We don't want that. We don't want these round trips. So here what really happens, it looks at my answers, breaks it up into part by part, evaluates that, which we call as LLM as a judge, which means his machine learning language is judging your quality of your response and getting into only those pieces which it has to go deeper in. Maybe my financial module was not great, right? It gets into it and starts that human in loop process. There has to be today with the rise of agents and agent frameworks. So many machines, how are they going to interact with humans? When do they know what to do? So all of that is intertwined in this. So it is just not the exploration of the space, but the machine telling you which spaces you need to explore and not everything.
I guess talking about agents and multi-agents, right? So one of the things that people struggle with still, Raji, is evaluation.
Yeah.
So not just of a single agent, but it turns out that most tasks require multi-agents for a variety of reasons, right? Because there's different skills involved, different tasks involved. You mentioned this example of brainstorming. Well, brainstorming sometimes, or most of the time, might connote drawing from different domain experts, different disciplines, right? So that connotes different agents, right? So it's how do you, so there's two questions here. So evaluation and transparency, how do we address these critical issues, right?
So. Right. So when it comes to evaluation, I would want to think about systems in terms of trustworthy systems, Ben, right? So it actually starts with that. And today, a lot of people focus evaluation on creating from a model engineering standpoint, right? Can I test with these kinds of human eval benchmarks to see how the system performs, right? And various mechanisms. But if you look at it, one critical piece of building these trustworthy systems is the how the interface itself is designed, right? And for this, I would like to take or talk about the anatomy of these conversations, right? So you have a human who has an intent, and the human is requesting the machine for a response, and there's a shared context, right? And if the shared context is not specified properly, you're not going to get a trustworthy response, right? And going back to the first point we discussed, prompt engineering is a very difficult way. If you do not give the right English description, you're going to go in a loop. And this is really critical for enterprise systems, wherein you have something, you're giving it to the system doesn't respond. So the shared context is one part which is important for building trust.
And not only that, they're very sensitive.
Very sensitive.
Right, because they're probabilistic systems, and so they may not even give you the same response.
Yeah, and going back to your first question, Ben, where you said every version within the same family, the prompts are not the same. The way you would tell a GPT-4o is not the same way you did for 3.5. Right? So the trustworthiness of the system breaks because you're dependent on prompt, and which is where the co-inhabited workspace really plays a big role, wherein the prompt is taken from the environment, right? If you're driving a car, you're braking, there is something in the environment which has to be organically picked up, right? So here, that is one aspect. The second part, Ben, which is once you give these questions to the machine actually uses its knowledge and reasons out, right? But the response part of it, imagine the legacy conversation. I have 20 million lines of COBOL code and I have created documentation. How are you going to expect these people to go through the documentation to see if it's right or wrong? So if you do not make the response in a way which is consumable by the user, that also is a problem, right? So trustworthiness of systems and in the context of agents and agent frameworks, this becomes a lot more complex. Where when these agents are going back, I'll give you a simple example, right? Humans, as humans, we just don't have factual knowledge. We have beliefs, right? Let's say you're in a highway and trying to merge in a highway, Ben. You're looking behind, you see the mirror, the person nods and gives you a thumbs up, right? You know that the person is going to let you go and slow down. If you were being replaced by, let's say, a self-driving car, which is coming in, it's going to calculate the actual distance. It's using factual data. It doesn't have a belief state or a belief system. For it to know that, hey, you know what? There is something like humans looking, nodding. So humans have this belief state, which today in an agent framework, if these are agents are going to talk to each other, and they have to take decisions, where is the belief state? And if they don't have the belief state, they get into something called as, you know, reasoning derailment. They don't know, or they incorrectly behave. So here again, we would be surprised that generative interfaces are a big way. While you can model these belief states mathematically, but if you don't have an interface which can bring it to life, you're going to have a problem. So I think from that perspective also, the agent question which you mentioned ties a lot, because having these belief states and going back, additionally, when you talk about agents, Or if you draw inspiration from nature, if you look at ants, the birds, the bees, right? They all have some sort of swarm intelligence. In an enterprise also, when you have one developer who's looking at a code versus a whole bunch of people working on a project, who's going to capture the belief state? Where are you going to capture that swarm intelligence per se? Right? So generative interfaces can be a beautiful way in that process to bring forth a lot of these things to life.
Yeah. And I think for our listeners, one of the keys is to understand the context of your application, right? So
yeah.
If your application is external facing, maybe your testing is going to be super, super rigorous. If it's internal facing and only among your peers and maybe a little more low stakes, maybe your testing is less. But, you know, I mean, I think there are ideas from traditional software engineering that still carry over, and people are trying to map them over to this world of agents and generative AI. So, for example, people are looking at agents and developing tools for essentially the equivalent of penetration testing, right? So how do we push this probe and push and really poke at this agent to make sure that it really is going to do what it's intended to do? So don't throw out all the ideas we had, but, you know, make sure that you understand that they don't map over completely seamlessly either.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we have to also think about generative interfaces slightly differently, Ben. When we started with the first example of a chat conversation, right, we are talking about a single user. When we talk about this co-inhabited workspace, it's about one user's potential being amplified and how the interface. But when you move on to the second or the third example you brought about agents, Ben, right, which is where the agents are there and you also have a group of people interacting. The common beliefs, right? A lot of what they do, that has to come through. So it's not just at project level. It is also at a group level wherein many people, when they are interacting with each other, it can come forth to light. And, you know, going back in emphasis, what we've done is, you know, let's say usually we have these large, big development engineering teams spread across the world doing different things, right? I may be a developer, someone may be a tester, somebody may be doing production support. What if each of our actions are contradicting? Let's say somebody has picked up the module for testing and found a bug and fixed it, and I'm going to pick it up the next day. Who's going to capture that knowledge? Right? So interfaces are a way that I can visualize, see semantically related aspects, which will help me to guide through what I need to do. So it's just not an individual behavior, but something which is also at a group. And these interfaces are very powerful, and they are not just in the domains of metaverse or gaming, but enterprises with purely software systems on tasks like legacy modernization to something more complex, right? A financial auditing system can be anything. It is applicable.
So before we leave this topic of interfaces, so would you be comfortable sharing to our audience some teams or some companies that you think are doing well in terms of some of these ideas? Obviously, we're still very early, right? But what examples are particularly interesting to you?
Yeah, I think, I tell you frankly, I really think we have a long way to go. What we have built inside in my company versus what I see as B2C, right? When consumers are using, there are a lot of these apps which are great. Last year, I had an opportunity, Ben, to look at some of the apps in the travel space, travel and tourism. They are pretty good, where augmented and virtual reality and extended reality space is moved in, right? Gaming is a great space, but traditional enterprise systems are still falling short, is my humble opinion.
So you've also talked about that companies need to understand the whole plethora and choices they have when it comes to these foundation models, right? So There's these large proprietary models. There's the open source models that you can tune and fine tune. But then now, increasingly, there's these even smaller specialized models.
That's right.
So, can you talk to our audience about the advantage some of these smaller models have as far as enterprise applications?
Sure. So when we look at enterprises, I think we find a great sweet spot between 3 to 7 billion parameter models. These are small. And today, when you look at large language models, right, they don't have the knowledge of something which is inside your organization in an enterprise. We have this product called Finacle, which is a banking product which started in 1980s. There's no way the code of that can be written by ChatGPT or the underlying GPT models or Claude models. It's not possible. So what we have really done is to move towards these open foundation models, which we can take, fine-tune them with our own data, and we have created a lot of small language models, which are not just energy efficient. They can run on your commodity hardware. So these issues of data privacy do not exist. So there are several advantages wherein these small language models, custom tuned for your own code, your own case, are a lot more effective. They do not leak the data outside your company and outside the enterprise. You don't get into any kind of, you know, regulatory issues because your data is going out. And most importantly, as I said, it is custom built. So this is indeed the way things are going, that yes, even in agents, when you talk about a multi-agent framework, each of the agents may need specialized tasks. So you do need models which are very specific. It's not that one large language model and, you know, everybody needs. So we are seeing that emergence, Ben, that there is a range of these models.
Yeah, and actually what I tell companies is that we're in an era where there's going to be a handful of companies focused on building these foundation models who are doing pre-training. So what you need to do in your team is probably make sure that you really excel and are really good at post-training, where post-training can mean a gamut of things, right? So fine-tuning, distillation even, and now fine-tuning, largely the supervised fine-tuning is largely a solved problem, I believe. All you need to do is have labeled data, which of course is hard. Because you still need to have a lot of, or at least, you know, depending on your problem, on the order of anywhere from a few hundred to several thousand labeled examples of here's a prompt, here's the response, right? But the good news is that it seems like for at least in areas like what you alluded to, Raji, which are these areas where you can verify a task like coding and programming, right? So where you can verify that, hey, this code will run. It seems like people are now able to do kind of customizing the model using reinforcement learning, right? So what they call reinforcement fine-tuning. So, and I believe that this whole area of customizing models will continue to get easy and will move alongside progress in foundation models, right? So
yeah.
If foundation models develop a certain capability, then the tools for customizing these models will also adapt. And so as Raji points out, the name of the game for most enterprises is to really excel at post-training. And all right, so you've also in the past advocated for responsible AI by design.
Mm-hmm.
So what does this look like in practice when you're talking to companies or starting to build AI applications?
Yeah. Responsible AI is a huge gamut, Ben, right? The whole idea beats if you take security by design or performance by design, the whole idea is not to think of responsible AI as an afterthought, but start designing the system for responsible AI earlier on, and that is very important. And today, if you really look at it, there's so many regulations. It could be from a sustainability perspective, fairness, ethics, bias. There are multitudes of dimensions, and each of these dimensions are very, very critical, right? And with complexity, on one hand, you're seeing the tech, you know, changing so fast. We sometimes don't even have time to think through the implications of it, right? Implications could be implications in terms of the future of our work, implications in terms of what happens when these systems fail and what is the consequences, right? There are many such incidences. If you look at this example of this triple negative breast cancer in women, machine learning algorithms could find it, but they used a bunch of data, and based on that cohort, you could do. Right? Now, what if that's not right? Right? So you come up with certain findings, but machine learning algorithms are double-edged sword, and responsible AI is also a very evolving area. You know, this agent derailment problems, which I've talked about. So there are multiple issues wherein I think we are not holistically looking at it. We are only thinking it from a tech perspective and forgetting what are the shortfalls we have.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about where we're at is that AI is completely accessible and democratized in many ways. That means, I think, for example, when you look at 5-6 years ago, when you talk about AI, well, that's the data science team or the machine learning team, and they're going to do that, right? So now AI is accessible to developers or even non-coders, or the decision makers themselves are using these AI tools, so they have a sense of what these AI tools are about. So a lot of these AI applications are much more interdisciplinary and interdepartmental than they ever have been before. And as you mentioned, you know, all this is happening in an age where, you know, while maybe the U.S. federal government is going to not move forward with regulation, it seems like the U.S. states, for example, are moving forward, right? So each of these applications now have many stakeholders and voices, but now you also have to be careful about the ramifications. So I don't think companies are really have wrapped their head around this problem about how do we stay compliant? How do we address governance? And then now we have so many more voices in the room, right?
Yeah.
So what are some of the best practices you've seen?
From a responsible AI standpoint?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think one big area, I think, Ben, is really about the work and the workforce transformation, right? Today, if you look at a lot of coding models, if you take clots on it, right, it outperforms a lot of programmers. So what is going to happen to the software industry? If you look back at the time when we had artisanal era, where people had very specialized tasks, right? There was a cobbler, there was a potter, people were doing different things. But when the industrial era came, each of this specialization went away. Nobody lost the job. But the nature of their work changed when we got into this era of industrialization, right? So I think one of the questions we need to ask ourselves as a society and industry and different levels is, how is the future of workforce going to look like? Whom are we going to hire? Whom are we going to reskill? What should our students be learning in school? Right? I think the impact, the direct impact to humans is what keeps me sleepless. I think about it, saying, I don't have an answer. You know, I use a lot of these tools. Yes, it does amplify me. I know that for using these tools, we need creativity. I don't deny that, but still, there'll be a huge percentage of us who are going to be threatened by it. And that is what I think is my thought process on this, you know.
So let me pose a thought experiment for you, right? So imagine we have the tools we have today.
Mm-hmm.
And then bring them over to 1999.
Mm-hmm.
Will these tools be able to address the Y2K bug? And you know how many companies, how many professional services companies might have been impacted?
Can't agree more on that.
Right? I mean, I think that a lot of these tools would be, I believe a lot of these tools would have been able to address.
Absolutely. Them. Absolutely.
Yeah. But as you say, I think people will adjust, right? So people will do other things. And actually, yesterday I had a conversation with one of the creators of one of these leading agent building tools, right? So, and I asked him to describe some early examples, and the descriptions were eerie based on what you just mentioned. So he was talking about, you know, we have agents that are, you know, think of agents working in collaboration, multiple agents. There's a manager, here's a director, you know, here's the worker. And then afterwards, after he described all of this, I'm going, so what will people do?
Yeah, Ben, that's one.
He did say this is, this is a few years. This is, you know, we're not there yet.
Yeah.
But you can imagine, you know, 5-10 years that
correct. Might happen. Exactly. That's the point. But the technology is moving very fast.
Yeah.
See, earlier when you look at it, in when the web came or the cloud computing came, right? They were impacting us. There was time for people to catch up. Today, my worry is the pace in which the technology is going is really dramatic. And I don't think we have the required safeguards. Agent and agent framework for the kind of publicity it has got, something very foundational to humans, when humans work, is missing in them. So I do think there are a lot of areas, but it's not impossible that they will catch up in a few years. But by then, are we ready as a society, as a community, for this dramatic change? A lot of kids today and the parents are so worried about what kids should be learning in school. What kind of skill set should we be imparting? You know, we need as a society not be doing guesswork, but there has to be a clear direction.
In closing then, so let's close by putting you on the spot here. So for our listeners who want to somewhat future-proof themselves in their career, any parting advice?
I would say that first of all, be a consumer of technology. Do not worry about building it. Today, AI is one tech which has been quite simplified in terms of commoditized as a user. It's democratized. Right. So I think very important that what distinguishes you as a professional is not denying the reality, but use AI in a way that it can augment you, make you better, do more with less, save your time, spend the time with the family, do things which you love, but do use AI is one thing I would say, Ben.
And with that, thank you, Ranjit.